Responsible for doing a lot of the work, especially the grad students who have worked so hard. I'll show you also some results from Agile Boltstran that has two different strains now, one at Oak Ridge and one at Basel. It was developed by Matthias and Tony Mezzacapa and myself in the last 10 years or so. And Eric Lentz has sort of taken up the mantle of maintainer at Oak Ridge right now, and I'm sure Tobias Fisher and Basel made a lot of improvements to the code, to the Basel branch of the code, and others in Basel, I think, are using the code currently as well. But a lot of what I want to show you is from our Chimera collaboration. I promised Matthias I would show this slide just to distill everything you sort of heard from him earlier and maybe put it in your mind one more time. I'm going to confine most of my discussion to this notion of a neutrino reheating paradigm for the supernova explosion. And sort of the picture to have in your mind, at least in a spherically symmetric sense, when you talk about the neutrino reheating paradigm, is to imagine a cooling protoneutron star at the center of the configuration with some accretion shock at some standoff distance. And then the essential point is to notice that there is a so-called gain radius between the neutrino spheres and the shock where heating will exactly match cooling in a spherically symmetric situation, and I'll show you some 2D simulations where it's fairly easy to pick out the gain radius as well. Below the gain radius, the capture, the emission and absorption processes sort of go this way, where basically the neutrinos are absorbed on neutrons and antineutrinos on protons. In the heating region, they go the other way. As Matthias showed you earlier, the density cliff, the strong density contrast between the surface of the protoneutron star and and at the radius of the shock provides a really sharp transition from cooling to heating. In spherically symmetric simulations, it's important to note, and Matthias also showed this, once a parcel of matter falls below the gain radius, it's lost. It'll be accreted onto the PNS and will not be part of the ejecta. Multidimensional simulations allow that to be circumvented to some extent, again, as he showed you, by hitting the parcel of matter with neutrino heating hard and fast as it falls below the shock, but before it gets to the gain radius, or even you can sometimes recover multidimensional simulations, things that would have fallen below the gain radius, you can actually recover them by letting them be in a convective overturn. So Matthias framed his talk this way, and I'll do the same. There are a few sort of prerequisites to be able to do a reasonably physically realistic supernova simulation, and I've listed the main culprits here. You have to have a decent gravity solver. You have to have some way to compute neutrino heating, some way to emit convection, because we know that in general stars these things do convect. There's protoneutron star convection that happens. There's post-shock convection that happens, just like on your stovetop, for example. Both of those have to be admitted. Despite Matthias's 3D simulations, I think that the SASE has become a ubiquitous feature of core collapse physics, and I think even in historical simulations, in a lot of cases, if you sort of look with our now jaundiced eye back at those, you can actually identify the impact of the SASE in a lot of those. You have to have some way to do nuclear burning. That's still happening in the star, and I think that's a microphysical input that's needed for most simulations. I'm not going to talk about it directly here, but I'll probably allude to it a couple of times. And especially it's especially important if you eventually want your simulations to be able to confront observations, right? Because a lot of the ejecta is still going to undergo nuclear burning processes, and it will be further processed during the explosive event itself and a little bit afterwards, and therefore to have a decent prescription for nuclear burning is important. We also know that these things in general do have magnetic fields, and the massive stars do in fact rotate in general. I don't think there's been a handful of schematic attempts to include both of these in previous simulations. I think Matthias showed us maybe the best shot in 3D of doing a physics-full supernova simulation with magnetic fields in any event. But I think that's part of the frontier. And eventually, we'll need 3D models with all of these. The reason they have to be 3D ultimately is something that was also alluded to earlier, the SASE, the standing accretion shock instability. If it's really important for revitalizing the shock and re-energizing the shock, it has a fundamentally different character in 3D than it does in 2D. The mode that eventually controls to what extent the shock is pushed outward is fundamentally different in 2D than it is in 3D. So our best attempt to be able to admit all of these these possible sources of importance is Chimera. The name of the code was completely back-engineered, and it's sort of to give you a hint about what its provenance is. It's three different codes, three different historical codes, a hydrodynamics code called VH1 that's publicly available, a nuclear network called XNET that was developed by Hicks and Thielemann, and Steve Bruin's multi-group flux-limited diffusion code that has a pedigree that's at least three decades at this point. They all sort of are slammed together with some glue, and that makes Chimera. For the Cognoscenti, I give a list of important parameters for the code. This last bullet is what I'll probably spend the rest of the time talking about. I took the admonition to make the talk centered on the microphysical input seriously, so I hope that comes through. It's about what neutrino emissivities and opacities we have included. I put standard here in quotes. I'll sort of define that a little more precisely in the next slide or so. Plus elastic scattering on nucleons and nucleon-nucleon Bremsstrahlung. The makeup of Chimera, you should contrast it strongly with the Garking's group's code as well. They're similar in many, many respects. The prescription for neutrino transport in the Garching code is also ray by ray. They use a similar sort of algorithm to compute the hydrodynamics with some slight changes. One important thing that they've done historically is they haven't used exactly the same progenitors. Both groups have not used exactly the same progenitors, and it's my suggestion that the differences in those progenitors, especially in the run of density in the silicon layer, is an important source of difference between the two sets of simulations. So just to show you some 2D Chimera simulations, what you're seeing here is entropy on a semi-transparent grayscale, and neutrino heating and cooling in a red-blue color map, and the entropy is superposed on top of the heating and cooling. You just saw bounce happen at a little over 400 milliseconds from past the onset of collapse. You can see the shock has become a standing accretion shock. You can also start to see the SASE developing with the side-to-side sloshing motion that happens. There's a clear gain radius that's been obtained in this part of the simulation. Now it starts to become significantly non-spherical, and it's sort of a bit harder to pick out a particular gain radius. One interesting thing is once these convective currents that Matthias described schematically in his talk sort of really set up, you can see that you get these low entropy downflows that are heavier. Heating really picks up along those downflows. And in fact, you can see individual rays popping energy into those downflows, heating them and pushing the material outward. So it's absolutely the case that sort of the coherence of each one of those heating events when a downflow comes down is the strict coherence of it is an effect of the ray by ray prescription that we have for the neutrino transport. Nevertheless, it is physical in some sense. If you had some sort of angle average neutrino transport, each one of those hot spots would be like it was spread over the entire surface of the PNS, and that's clearly unphysical. So although we're probably not getting the full transport right from ray to ray, because those are episodic events, to some extent we are getting the correct neutrino transport. So there was an earlier question from Achim. What are the important neutrino emissivities and opacities? I think this is a very similar list to what Matthias had up. Above this line is what I had termed standard. They're sort of like the lore that was handed down in Bruin 85. These two in yellow, these wholly leptonic sort of sources, I mean, I think those are fairly well understood, and everybody uses the same interaction kernels. Those are processes that even I can write down the Lagrangian 4 and do the Feynman diagrams for, so I don't have to worry. It's stuff that has to do with strong interaction physics that's perhaps a little bit different. In particular, the absorption, emission and absorption on nucleons, on nuclei. This was really pushed forward recently with these introductions of electron capture rates by Langanka et al., and we discussed this briefly yesterday afternoon, how important those things were. They need to be extended ultimately to higher and higher A, even A's where the nuclear physicists would insist that we're not talking about nuclei anymore, but maybe larger, even larger coherent structures that are held together with some sort of strong interaction. This scattering on N's, P's, and A's, In the past, that was strictly isoenergetic. There was no energy transfer from the neutrino field to the matter. That's recently changed with the work of Reddy et al. And others. Now we can actually admit these in simulations. The energy exchange is small for each one of those events, but there's lots of those scatterings. In practical terms, this often presents a problem for the limited energy resolution that we have in simulations, and you often have to have some sort of restriction to handle that. But it can be admitted. Some relatively new physics from the past decade is nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung, and this annihilation and creation channel through new bar goes to new bar. That requires a whole new set of couplings in most of the codes. For the most part, new E's, each flavor has been in the past solved independently of one another. When you have this sort of event happening, you have to solve all the flavors all at once if you have a full Boltzmann or even a multi-group flux-limited diffusion approach. That's actually not what was done in Burris et al. This process was actually written down as an effective emissivity. So this probably needs to be revisited and put on a firmer ground. So let me just pick one of these new processes. This nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung. If I actually stick in nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung into an agile Boltzmann simulation, the original without the bremsstrahlung is the black line. What you're seeing is a flipbook movie of the new mu tau luminosity as a function of radius from about the onset of collapse. This should be collapse, not bounce, to about 50 milliseconds post-bounce. You can see that early on, the luminosity, the mu and tau luminosity, is dominated by the signal from the bremsstrahlung. But once you get post-bounce and after the neutrinos have broken out of the neutrino spheres, after the shock has passed through the neutrino spheres, you can see that there's almost no difference in the luminosity. That's because the bremsstrahlung will dominate at the high densities. The optical depth is very large there, and therefore you're not going to get any flux from where the bremsstrahlung is actually dominating. Whereas before bounce, when there aren't any positrons to speak of, the bremsstrahlung is the only channel available to generate the mus and taus. Nevertheless, you do get a softening of the spectrum of mus and taus from deep in the core due to the bremsstrahlung events. And I'm hoping that Evan will tell us a little bit about the impact of that or things like it when he talks about neutrino oscillations later this afternoon. Perhaps having a softened spectrum from down deep is important for those kind of things. So when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So in an attempt to try to peel back what's important among those microphysical inputs that I showed you on a couple of slides previous, we've done a series of 1D simulations using the 1D mode of Chimera, and also show you some agile Boltzmann results to sort of take away what we think are the most important pieces of microphysics sort of one at a time and see what the problem is. Now, this sort of picture will become a logo in your head if you look at it long enough. This is what happens in all 1D simulations. The shock is born, it goes out to some stall radius, as we've seen in a couple of movies already, and then because it's 1D, it falls back into the potential well eventually. But what we can see is that the way the shock is born and how far it actually propagates has a strong dependence on what kind of physics you include. So the blue and the red have the full panoply of microphysics that I showed in the slide earlier. Bremsstrahlung, there are no ion-ion correlations in these simulations, and there's no influence from weak magnetism. But everything else that was on that previous slide is in there. This green line is what I'm calling reduced Newtonian. That is, the electron capture rates on nuclei during collapse have been removed, and both of the primary ways to transfer energy to the matter, that is through neutrino electron scattering and through the inelastic scattering on nucleons, have been removed from the simulation. And you can see that that has a fairly profound effect on the shock radius. You can see that they sort of match up for a while, maybe to maximum shock extent, and then they change. I'll show you an agile Boltzmann plot that shows you that's perhaps just an accident in some sense. And then something that Matias referred to obliquely and rather quickly, we did another run where we took away the influence of observer corrections. Now, we retained the compression effect, but everything else is gone. Because just like Matias, in Agile Boltstrand, he explained to you, we have to solve for the specific distribution function. If you take away the compressive effects, there's no way you'll be able to solve the equation that you're actually looking to solve. This has a really profound effect on the shock trajectory. Leaving off the observer corrections can turn what would be perhaps a very optimistic propagation of the shock to a very, very pessimistic excursion of the shock. Those are from Chimera. We did the same, a subset of the same. I don't have all the curves on this plot, unfortunately, because things don't run when I want them to. Nevertheless, you can see that for the most part, these things look the same. The sort of extent of maximum, the maximum shock extent for the GR and Newtonian runs are roughly the same. The reduced Newtonian has roughly the same behavior, but it's just sort of crossing over this reduced Newtonian line at some point. I think this is really a strong function of what your prescription for transport is. And I would make no warranties about the validity of this green line other than the fact that it's different than the blue line. Yes? So this is the radius at which the shock is present. So that's easy. I just pick it off. These are 1D simulations, so it's a Schwarzschild metric. So I'm sorry? Oh, this. For example, the core actually rings a little bit, and as the shock plowing out, again, because this is not really a physical simulation, we haven't explored exactly what leads to that ringing. Nevertheless, it is there. To show you that this isn't an accident of some of the rest of the setup, I'll show you some neutrino quantities from that Agile Boltstrand. Those Agile Boltstrand simulations, you can see that these reduced or slight, the runs with reduced physics in the blue, the green, the yellow, they collapse a little bit quicker, and therefore the breakout luminosity comes a little bit sooner. They are significantly different than the other ones in GR and in Newtonian gravity. Some of this effect, not much of this effect really, except for the mu's and tau's. This was only nu e's. If I then look at the root mean square energies for all flavors of neutrinos, I can see that when I take stalling away and these energy modulating effects away, I get much bigger root mean square energies as a function of time at 500 kilometers in the co-moving frame than I would when I had Bremsstrahlung and energy modulating processes included in the simulation. So the bottom line for all this is that observer corrections are important to get the right answer dynamically, and it seems that energy exchange processes, energy exchange between the neutrino radiation field and the matter, are also important to get the right answer or anything close to the right answer. You can really see this if you just do the simulation, and you actually do a 2D simulation with Chimera with and without the so-called complete new rates. And again, reduced here means no scattering that transfers energy from the neutrino radiation field to the matter. What's marked for each one of these is the maximum shock extent, the minimum shock extent, and the average shock extent over the hemisphere that we simulate. And you see there's a profound difference. And the 1D simulations that fail are the line very near the origin down here at the bottom. The effect is actually much greater than any impact that resolution might have. The first number here is the number of radial zones in a 2D simulation with Chimera, and the second number is the number of angular bends in a 2D simulation of Chimera. So we feel that we've pretty much converged in resolution, and the differences that we see from including the neutrino interactions or not are much greater than any impact that resolution might actually have. So something I've been talking, I wanted to do a little commercial here at near the end of the talk. Something I've been talking to several people about is this notion of not only having tabular EOSs, but having tabular sets of neutrino interactions. Ultimately, those have to be combined with an EOS. You know, even the way we do things now, for example, if I wanted to tabulate Latimer Celesti along with all of my weak interaction physics, ultimately I need the chemical potentials from Latimer Celesti. So that all needs to be in a single table. We already sort of do this. We have yet another code at Oak Ridge called Genesis that currently uses a library called Global Arrays to store and copy a global interaction table. It sort of does this on the fly. It reads the table, uses it. If it needs a new point, it computes it and stores it. This needs to be backported to Chimera. So I've realized this, and this is why. The recomputation of these local interaction physical kernels have lots of exponentials. They have square roots, things that computers don't do well. And therefore, they're a huge slowdown. So even if I do what I do in Chimera, which is use local interpolation cubes to each MPI rank, this turns out to be a huge source of load imbalance and is actually perhaps the primary reason I get slowdowns in Chimera when I'm running on hundreds of thousands of processors at Oak Ridge. Ultimately, again, and several groups I think are working on this, the weak interaction kernels have to be integrated into the EOS, and I'd like to make this available to everyone in some sort of open source manner. Let me see why I think it's feasible. If I have four flavors, 20 energy groups, Matias did this exact same calculation, I think, on an earlier slide. I said that maybe we can get away with 16 squared angles, and that's at worst. That's if you tabulate each individual pair of angles rather than the angle between any two. There's a little bit of degeneracy and a little bit of savings to be had there. A typical EOS table resolution is, we've seen repeatedly already, is maybe 50 by 100 by 100. That means that I'll end up with a table that's of size roughly 40 gigabytes. Now, that's big, but on a modern cluster, even with a couple of hundred processors, that can be distributed among the nodes rather straightforwardly and not take a lot of memory away from the computations that are going on each individual core or each individual processor. And the second point is I think that things like global arrays, Core Array Fortran, UPC, Chapel, there's a ton of different widely available ways to access a globally distributed data structure like this that will actually perform nowadays, especially with modern networks. So I think you really have a shot at being able to do this and have it not be an impact on these large, very large simulation codes. The assumption, I'm making an assumption here that everybody would use the table like I would use the table, and in fact everybody would have a local cache of the interactions that they need for a particular spatial zone or a particular group of spatial zones. I think that's probably important to really get the performance up. So, in closing, and I promise Christian actually made this summary slide before I saw his slide earlier that had Micra spelled down the left. Energy transferring neutrino interactions have a profound effect on the shock dynamics, and they can't be neglected. Charge and neutral current interactions on nuclei need a better implementation and integration with the EOS. We need to be able to branch where we know we have big fat nuclei and where we have uniform nuclear matter. There's a lot of spectrum formation that goes on in there, and a lot of it seems to be dependent upon production and scattering off of large coherent structures made coherent through the strong interaction. In computational terms, near future, and I mean now, not in 2 or 3 years, you know, modern computers are going to becoming massively multi-core machines. Clock rates are not only not increasing anymore, they're dropping. And the amount of memory that you have available to do simulations like this per flop that you actually do is dropping precipitously for that reason. We're not going to be able to do bigger and bigger and bigger simulations, but what we do have a hope of doing is if we can find the parallelism to be able to do better and better physical fidelity with the same number of grid points and maybe at a much higher duty cycle. Maybe I can do many more simulations in a given week, which is like, you know, I can do a quarter of a simulation in a week now. I'd like to be able to do 5 or 6 simulations in a week eventually on a machine that I'll have 2 years from now, but that won't be a simulation that has vastly different spatial resolution. The EOS and neutrino interaction tables are small enough to be distributed across even modest sort of departmental size clusters. Incorporating GR gravity, I hope you saw from my earlier slides, having the GR gravity in these 2 and 3D simulations is important. It has an effect on the shock dynamics that's roughly comparable to neglecting some of the microphysics. And regardless of whether or not these things have a dynamic effect, for example, I don't think nuclei-on-nuclei Bremsstrahlung has a particular dynamic effect on the shock propagation. Nevertheless, it is important if you want to actually confront observations. You confront observations from neutrino observatories and other places So they have to be included in the simulations, otherwise the computation is just a lot of hand waving. And with that, I'll end.
Could you show me again the 2D exploding model?
You mean
yes, the yes. And I think the shock waves is rather continuously growing. Did you observe anything?
You mean let me try to point out. You mean this?
Yes.
And this and this. Those are artifacts of those are angular. That's an angular average. And so those are artifacts of the shock finding algorithm and then the average.
So just you can observe the SASE activity.
Didn't try to smooth them because I actually wanted the data to show up, but those are all, these little dropouts are because the SASE makes the explosion very aspherical, all it takes is one nice SASE oscillation superposed on maybe a convective overturn to really change the average radius of the shock.
I see.
Over small temporal.
And region. Again, could you show me the 2D results with different numerical resolutions?
Other resolutions, huh? Here?
Yeah.
So you can see the same sort of dropouts and things like this. If you were to go from point to point here, that would be probably half a SASE period for the 2D simulations, for example.
So you said that this simulation is converged.
Yes, I said that.
So what is what do you think is a physical mechanism that determines the saturation level of SASE? If the simulation is converged, I think the saturation level of SASE is accurately determined. Like,
I'm not sure I understand the question completely. I would say that. Perhaps we've not been interested in 2D in finding the saturation of the SASE because we know it's fundamentally different in 3D. Therefore, we've just been trying to gauge its effect on the full-up simulation.
So did you compare the, such as a propagation of pressure wave?
Oh, like a power in the mode or something
like that? Yeah,
I have that plot, but not with me, yeah.
Thank you.
In the list of neutrino reactions you have included, I saw at least two that you have not listed, which are a neutrino inelastic scattering in nuclei and the same in nucleons.
Yes. So I left the second one I left off, and it shouldn't have been left off. That we have. But not the inelastic on nuclei. That is not incorporated in any of our simulations currently. The
recoil effects?
Yes, recoil effects. Yeah. All the Reddy percussion Latimer prescription. And again, the energy exchange in each of those events is vanishingly small and is usually smaller than our smallest energy grid. So we have to have some prescription to do that integration.
But this is not what at least I mean by inelastic. With inelastic in nucleons, I mean the same than prestralon, but putting the antineutrino in the left hand side.
You mean this and just...
No. The Bernstrahlung, you have NN going to neutrino, antineutrino pair below.
Oh, here. Yeah. Right. No, that's right. So, rather, we have this. Yeah, we don't have the cross diagram of this process included at all.
I think that would be something very important to look at because already Hannestad and Raphael pointed out that the energy transfer in this reaction is much more efficient than in recoil. And we also looked at this with Chris Pethick, where we explicitly made a figure and showed that the mean energy transfer is large.
For the cross diagram of this process,
right.
Yeah. I think the argument, and I'll have to check. I think the argument is that it happens at such high density that perhaps it's not that important to us. But I need to check that.
Right. So can you say then actually more at which densities recoil effects are important?
They seem to be important at sort of intermediate densities near the bottom of the semi-transparent regime, where spectral formation will show up. So several times 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 13 grams per cubic centimeter.
Okay, I think this still holds that this is more efficient than recoil.
You showed comparison between sets of simulations with comprehensive and reduced interactions. I did not get quite which is the difference between these two sets. Is this split on this transparency?
Yes.
And if so, could you specify with all the additions which makes the large effect,
yes.
which makes the small
yes.
effect?
So anytime you saw reduced, certainly these two, the ones below the line, are gone. For most of the reduced, this and the energy exchange portion of this are also missing. In every case, we do have pairs. I'm sorry. In every case, we do have pairs, and in every case, we have a non-energy transfer version of this, so an isoenergetic scattering on nucleons. The NES is gone for any of the reduced, and the energy exchange version of this reaction is gone for any of the reduced.
But if you leave out the electron capture on protons...
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's there. Mm-hmm. It's there. The last term, the electron capture on nuclei for most of the reduced, for some of the reduced, is also gone. They were marked with no EE prime. We also take away the electron capture table during collapse for those.
And now which one makes the largest difference?
Yeah, it looks like it's a competition between this one and this one. And they're roughly half of the effect for example, the peak luminosity in each of those cases.
So I want to understand your implementation of the weak reaction rates in parallel computing. Mm-hmm. So your suggestion is to provide a big table of the weak reaction rates beforehand instead of calculating on the fly in the parallel
yes.
computing?
Yes.
So do you think that the current computing resources is enough for stored all?
Yeah, I think that the production of such a table is something that can be done, probably needs a big computer itself to be done with a reasonable duty cycle. But I think the important point is the size of the table itself grows very fast because of the inclusion of energy groups, kinematic types. When I say kinematic types here, there's only about four kinematic types that any of these reactions flow into. There's a scattering event, something that looks like emission and absorption, something that looks like a pair production, and maybe the cross diagrams. And so the all these processes could be subsumed there because they have the kernels would have the same dimensionality. And then the number of angles. So if I do maybe a worst case calculation back of the envelope, I only get a table that's 40 gigabytes. Now, that's much larger than the 30 or 50 megabytes that the Shinna EOS table produces. But I don't have to have a copy of all of this table on every local process. In fact, I can distribute it globally and then use a variety of ways to be able to query it, get a local cache of the stuff I need, and then throw it away when I no longer need it anymore. So I think it's really the fact that this will fit on even your departmental machine and not rob your simulation itself of memory that you really need to do computation, and that there are modern ways to address that global memory structure that perform well, not just are functional, but actually perform well.
Just ask about neutrino rates again. So on the slide where you showed what some of the important ones, you had, for example, for Bremsstrahlung or for neutrino nucleon scattering, you had several calculations there by Sanjay et al. And Adam company, and they give different structure factors.
Yes.
And for Bremsstrahlung, you have different
Right.
Different ones. Can you say how they impact?
Yeah, so we, in fact, in each of these cases, I've tried to give full credit to everybody who worked on the problem and where implementations are available. We, in fact, implement the Ready et al. Prescription for this, and we implement the Hannestad and Rufelt prescription for that, and we have not tried any of the other prescriptions.
You haven't tried? Okay.
Yeah.
Really give a big incentive to revisit some of these things.
We had a longitudinal study of the different prescriptions, right?
Yeah. So my question is about supercomputer. So usually, how many CPUs do you use, and about the scalability of your code?
Yeah. So let me go for the 2D simulations here. We often use as many MPI ranks as there are rays. So 256 or 512 or 128 individual MPI ranks. For weak scaling, we're perfectly weak scaling out to 1,024 for the 2D simulations, and they take roughly a week to run. Total dwell time, not wall clock time, you know, that's usually spread out over roughly a month or so. The 3D version of Chimera, which can be turned on by simply flipping a switch, we run as high as all 224,000 processors on Jaguar. And at 224,000 processors compared to 32 processors, we have 70% parallel efficiency.
So in this simulation, neutrino electron scattering is also in neutrino electron scattering
yes.
Is also included. And
yes.
You can get the weak scaling.
Yes.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.